about to hear are the opinions, suggestions, and observations of a licensed real estate broker in California. Since each situation can be unique, do not consider anything said here as legal advice for your specific needs. Always seek out the advice of a suitable professional in your area for advice tailored to your situation. Please remember that when following advice, your results may vary. Please also understand that the information provided here is not intended to cover all aspects of the subject material, but rather a sample of issues the speaker considers important.
You seem to understand. I'm not locked in here with you. You're locked in here with me.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. My name's Robert Whitelaw, and I am the Rebel Broker. Member of the National Association of Realtors, but please, don't hold that against me. Here to give you all the latest inside scoop on all things real estate related. It's been a while. Once again, it's been a while. I'm just going to stop saying it because it seems like every other show I do, I have to say it because it's been a while. And here we are at 8 o'clock on a Wednesday, which is totally not a show day, but it was finally a window of time. I had finally wrapped up my day at around 7:30. I had planned to do the show earlier today. I actually posted on the Facebook page. Someone was asking when I was going to do my next show. And I got up this morning thinking I got to find some time to do a show today. But of course, I frequently wake up thinking that and then running out of time. And often, you know, when it gets to this time of the evening, I'm done. I mean, I've had a full day. I've had to run around and do various things and take care of different stuff. And typically I'm ready for it to be over. But it had been too long. So I wanted to sit down and sort of give you all the update. We're going to talk about when to fire your lender. It's a little bit more real world. It's not a lot of theory because I had to do it a couple of weeks back. Last week I was out camping with the kiddos. They had their week off from school. So we went to a place called Tree Bones in Big Sur, which is less a campground and more a glamp ground, which is supposed to be glamorous camping, I guess, which according to my experience translates into extremely overpriced tents. And at some point my kids and I were doing the math in this tent called a yurt and realized that we could have gone to Disneyland and stayed in the Grand Californian Hotel for less per night than we were spending in this tent. So, you know, and when you get to Big Sur, you're halfway to Disneyland already. So we started wondering if maybe we had made the right call. But no, it was a good time. We did Hearst Castle and we did the camping and hiking thing and had a really, really good time. So it was an overpriced time, but a good time. So I don't know, the Tree Bones place, I don't know how many folks are going to care one way or the other about the Tree Bones place. Great place. But if you ever go to Tree Bones and you do that, don't plan on spending any time during the day inside of one of those things. If the sun is out, it gets like steam room hot in those things. Even with the doors open and there's a little lid on the top, the little clear dome that you open up to let the air flow through. It was horrible. It was terrible. So we had the second or third day we had come home early from doing something and thought we brought Risk. So we'd play Risk there, which turned into a huge deal. I won because that's the way dad rolls. Anyway. We actually had to photograph the board because it was time to go. We had to photograph the board and then set the board back up at home so we could continue the game of Risk. And to be honest with you, at that point, I wanted the game to be over because it looked like I was going to lose hard. But then at the last minute in the clutch, I got the huge reinforcements and I was able to take over the world. So that's wonderful. And I'm sure you all care a whole lot about that. Still things moving forward with my personal journey for real estate investment. And I don't know if it's because I'm finding myself just a little bit superstitious, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to jinx it by talking about stuff while it's going on. So I'm kind of not going to do that. In a couple of weeks, I should be able to have a discussion about the details. And then, of course, as I'm doing things after the title is done and it's officially done and it's in my hands and I can do whatever I want, I'll, as I go through, I will do an update on that stuff. And I realize, you know, I get weird messages from folks. I get some folks that say, hey, love the fact that you kind of pull all these different real estate things out of the air, whether it's investing or whether it's stats or whether trying to make a connection with what is or might happen in real estate with economic things. So I get some of you who love that. I get some of you who hate that. And I get some of you requesting to sequester one part from another part. So because we could talk an awful lot about the investment thing, I'm actually toying with making the investment thing sort of a show by itself. So whenever I'm talking about my personal thing, and I'm trying to decide what to call it, because I'm almost considering calling it practicing what you preach. I know for a lot of years, I have sat here and given people an awful lot of advice that I thought was really good that I never followed. Talked a lot about following it. Always found an excuse not to follow it. Kind of had this revelation over the last 6 months to a year that I was an idiot and I should be following my own advice. And I was coming up with a lot of baloney reasons to not, you know, put it out there and actually do what I suggest people do. And I've equated that with, you know, maids who keep a dirty house or contractors who constantly have unfinished or out of date work in their own house while they spend all their time updating other people's houses. And that's not good. Right. So instead of trying to give you hypotheticals, instead of trying to give you theories or, and maybe even a little better, sharing secondhand real world experiences that I've come across with clients I've worked with, it would be nice if I could share with you my personal actual experience. And we've got a lot of little data. We've got some great little real estate nuggets that we can talk about, including one that's sort of a really harkens back to stuff we talked about. It's probably been years now since we started talking about how the big purchase of foreclosure properties was being done by companies that aren't in the business of real estate. And what I kind of projected would happen down the road is happening with some of these big players. So we'll talk about that too. And we'll see if it has an effect. I was thinking when it did happen, it would have an effect. But because of the way the market is right now, it may not. It may have a negligible effect, or the effect might actually be subtle enough on the overall market that it's actually a good thing. So we'll chat about that and see if that's something you agree with. The chat room is open. So if you'd like to communicate via that, please feel free. You can head on over to www.therebelbroker.com and then follow the lead to, or the link to the Blog Talk Radio Show page. And there's a chat room kind of running out there. If you don't have access, if you're out mobile, I again, folks who I've talked to who listen to the show, I don't know how you do it. I've never done it. I don't listen to it live while you're on your mobile device. So I'm not sure how that happens. I had someone suggest I start using Periscope to do my show. I haven't really looked into it. I know there was some great little news blurbs. There was something just before it called Meerkat, I guess. And then a couple of days, and everyone thought Meerkat was going to take off. A couple of days later, literally Periscope gets announced and it's going to be owned by big guys. And suddenly Meerkat is going the way of the dodo with only 72 hours of fame. What else? I have Skype running. So for those of you who are mobile, that's where I was going with that discussion. For those of you who are mobile, I did go ahead and open up Skype. I've had people say, why don't you open up your Skype? And I'm not sure where you get this stuff. I used Skype like 3 years ago and you talk like I used to do it all the time. I did it once, I think. So if you'd like to chat via Skype from your mobile device, you can do that. You can just search on me, Robert Whitelaw, or you can search on Rebel Broker. Either one of those should find me. All I ask is that when you send the request to just chat with me, mention that you're listening to the show so that I know, because there's plenty of those folks in India who want to make my website rank higher who constantly pester me on this thing. So when they just use the default text of I'd like to add you to my contacts list or I'd like to contact you, I say, can you please tell me how you know me? And if they can't tell me how they know me, then I do not give them permission. So anyway, just do that and I'll be a happy guy. All right. I'm going to go ahead and just jump right in. We'll see how far I get before it becomes sleepy time for me. I'm an old man, so I like to go to bed early and get up early. But anyway, let's just in general terms, so that I don't jinx my current deal, talk about when to fire your lender. We're just going to jump right in, go for the heart right at the start. Now, hopefully you're spending as much time interviewing and evaluating who your lender should be as you do your real estate agent. But there's, your real estate agent, it's easy to ask a lot of specific questions. You can try to get some data. With lenders, it's a little tougher. because a lot of times you're not shopping for the lender. You're shopping for the product the lender is going to sell you, which is the loan, right? Now, in my case, I went with a lender that my favorite lender, Tracy Starbuck, suggested I work with because unfortunately she is not licensed in the state where this loan was going to happen. So she had to refer me to someone else that was in her organization who could do that state. Problems right from the get-go. Warning lights were going off immediately. Now, the first warning light was one I can't blame them for. It was an email thing and I got it worked out, but there were warning signs even then because it was even the communication relating the verbal communication via phone was not matching with what I was seeing. They were saying they were getting my emails, but then I'd say, well, then you should have this, this, and this, and they didn't have those things. So it was, there was a little weirdness there in terms of that stuff. But in my case, okay, let me cut this into two pieces for you. There is the, I don't yet have a property in mind yet phase, right? Because you should be shopping for your loan before you find the house you want to buy. That the information you're going to get from your lender is going to be absolutely necessary for you to even figure out how you should be searching for a home. Okay. So the very first step should be talk to a lender and talk to several, talk to like five. And this is information we've talked about before, but I suggest talking to the bank you currently bank with, whatever that bank may be, a credit union, a loan broker, and a small local bank, and a small direct lender, which means they don't sell you someone else's loan. They actually loan the money to you themselves. I usually combine the loan broker with the direct lender because Tracy Starbuck, and I think this is still true for Tracy. It was at the last company she was at. I think it's still true in the new company she's at, where they not only will turn you onto a loan product from somewhere that fits your needs, but they can also do direct lending themselves where they lend you the money. Okay. So consult with all those folks. And of course, what you're going to do then is with a spreadsheet, you're going to sit down and you're going to compare these loans, what they'll cost you, what the points are, interest rates, all that wonderful stuff. And that's great. But just like with anything else, so much of what is going to define whether or not you're successful is how your lender carries the ball for you when it comes time to buy the place, right? We all know from articles you've probably come across, and if you've had chats with real estate folks, still the one of the major things that stops real estate deals from happening is the lending process, right? Ultimately not qualifying, have some weird thing happen, the house doesn't appraise. That can be a whole other subject. I have a firsthand appraisal story we can go into, and I'm debating whether or not to talk about it in this show. I'm so hot to I feel like I've established a very delicate universal balance with the deal I'm trying to get closed here, and I don't want to screw it up with some sort of weird karmic blowing on the scales kind of thing. I know it sounds goofy, but in any event, so we've got the two windows. We've got the before you have found the property window, which everybody should be doing this before that, and then we've got the we've made the offer and we're already in the process phase. And to be really honest, once you are in the we're already in contract and we're looking to close phase, it is really a tough call to decide whether or not you should fire your lender and get a new one. Because if, and particularly depending on how far in you are, if you are more than 2 weeks away from close of escrow, maybe you can fire your lender and get a new one. If you're closer than that, you'd need to shop for a lender who says, I can absolutely positively deliver by your close of escrow, right? That represents a risk in and of itself that the incompetence of your lender would have to far outweigh it. If you're absolutely convinced that your loan isn't going to close because of your lender's incompetence or because of whatever's going on with your lender, then absolutely you need to fire them anyway. If you're convinced it's not going to go through, well, then the deal's not going to happen. So to make it happen, you have to change. Now, I kind of go with my gut, and it's always served me well. At the very beginning of a transaction, I will usually meet at least via phone or email my buyer's lender when we're about to make an offer, because the first thing I do is ask them for a pre-qualification letter so that I can include that with an offer. We know we want to show that we've, that someone has looked at the paperwork and decided that these folks can borrow the money they need to live up to the promises made in our offer, right? 9 times out of 10, I will call this lender because I like to hear the voice. If I can't look right into their beady little eyes and kind of get a vibe off of that, I like to at least get a vibe off of the conversation. What kind of a vibe do I get? And if I get a really creepy vibe, I will talk to other lenders or encourage my buyers to create a backup relationship with someone, which may include doing all the paperwork, having it all ready to go, just in case. Now, do I have to do this frequently? No. Have I done it? Yeah. The last time I did it was maybe the most dramatic. I mean, I did it once. I did it 2 years ago. We didn't end up needing it. The last time we ended up needing it was probably, 12 years ago. And this was in a more dynamic situation where these were homes that had been mobile homes at one time, but were converted to real property by being put on foundations. And if you looked at them, they looked like stick built homes. These things were nowhere near being mobile homes anymore. They weren't the double wide, single wide thing at all. They were for all intents and purposes built stick built homes. But they were in a mobile home park where everybody really converted it to real property, but banks were cagey about it because it was a mobile home park. And I had a buyer who insisted on using Wells Fargo, knew for a fact Wells Fargo would not come through on this loan. No question in my mind. Talked to the Wells Fargo lender. Oh, no, we can absolutely do it. I've talked to everybody. Well, okay, whatever. I knew that all the main banks, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Chase, none of them would loan in this place. I knew it because that's like asking me if water is wet. I've experience taught me. So I begged the buyers to at least go through all the paperwork with this other, I forget what it was called, Santa Cruz Federal or Santa Cruz Credit Union or something. I think it was actually a credit union in Santa Cruz somewhere, who did loan. So I just had them fill out all the paperwork and get everything done so that the only thing that had to happen, and I said, I made them a bet. They didn't want to pay for a second appraisal because these folks wanted a separate appraisal, the other place. So I said, I tell you what, I will pay for the appraisal. If we end up having to use this second loan, you have to pay for the appraisal. You have to reimburse me for it. And they're all. And what happened was the Wells Fargo guy said, hey, if that happens, I'll pay for the appraisal. And that's what ended up happening. Literally, 3 days before close of escrow, he comes back and says, okay, it went to underwriting and they won't do it. That's what I told you would happen. So he ended up writing me a check for the appraisal amount. And everything was ready to go. They had done the appraisal. They'd signed everything off. And of course, we did have to push back escrow, but we were able to push it through, have it go to underwriting, have it get done. Did it in 6 days. So at least there was that. So we did have to push back a little bit, but it wasn't earth shattering. And I had already prepared the sellers in this case for the fact that I was 99% sure this wasn't going to go through. So they should have flexible moving plans made or just plan to move and still go at the same time, but the money won't be available. And lucky in this case, they weren't relying on the funds being there on that specific day to facilitate another purchase. They were going someplace they had already purchased. So anyway, it all worked out. And under those circumstances, so much of what's going to save you in these cases is going to be your gut. So there's a really bad example where just because of experience I had in that marketplace, I knew that this loan wasn't going to come through. So I approached it that way. But so what was it in my case that made me jump ship? Lender seemed like a nice guy from an interpersonal standpoint. He seemed like a good guy. Not real good at returning phone calls. And a lot of that, you can weigh one way or the other. You know, if he's super busy, is it a situation where maybe he doesn't call back until it's a time critical thing? Maybe he's one of those guys that prioritizes things. So maybe he's got clients who are closer to closing or are making offers. And maybe he's just getting back to me with a little bit more lag time because my questions aren't things that are critical to making something happen or not happen. All right. So I was cutting them a little slack on that. But one thing I absolutely demand and that you should demand from a lender is respect for your critical information. This is for those of you who've heard the promo that I have for this show that I run every now and again, if I need to take a break in the middle of the show, you know, I talk about Bank of America, and the thing I'm complaining about is how my client's information, they kept asking for the same information over and over again. So that leaves me thinking that somewhere in Bank of America, in the lending office somewhere, is a fax machine that keeps printing out my client's confidential information and no one ever goes and gets it, or it's sitting on the printer, or it's whatever. And that just scares the crap out of me for my clients, that they're, that this information that they have filled out and sent to these folks is being so mishandled, no one even realizes they've gotten it 8 times already. All right, so that is scary stuff. And I really only have a couple of rules for lenders that I work with. One, get back to me quick. And two, treat my data like it's, well, treat your data like it's my data. Maybe you're cavalier with your data, but I don't want anyone else to get all my information and be able to steal my identity by intercepting one email or one hunk of paper, right? So you, what does that mean to me? How does that translate into you? Well, there's levels of confidence, right? So one is, if you want to stay digital, they need to have a secure update server. That means that there is a password protected upload server where you can upload the documents. And when you've uploaded them, there's no way for you to then view them as PDFs or download them again using the portal that you've used. The reason I say that is because a lot of times what they'll send you is just a link that doesn't require any login and password. And what it does is it lets you upload it into their system, and then it sends an email to a person whose information was included in the link that they have you click. It says, okay, this person's going to click this link, and when they arrive at this page, anything they upload, send it to this person at the company. And that's how most of them work. That's how my tax guy works. That's how the lenders I like to work with work. And it's just a way for you to be able to upload it and create a list and show it and see a list of what you've described of what you sent, but it doesn't let you then access it, because then someone else could use that link in a malicious way, since it didn't require a password, to then get access to it. So you want to make sure it's not a two-way street. You want to make sure it's a send them documents thing only. If they're going to send you documents, they should then send you a separate link that requires you to verify your email address when you go to that link to download it, right? Okay. So some sort of secure document exchange thing. If I really, and I haven't had to do this in a while, but if I had a really good lender who didn't have a secure way to get me stuff and wanted me to just email them PDFs of my stuff, I would provide the secure server. I have access to a thing that has secure document handling, so I would do that. And here's another thing. And this is one we've never talked about before as it relates to real estate agents. One I've always been anal about but never talked about for some reason. Your agent should have the same thing. So for instance, I use a service to manage my escrows. So when I open an escrow, I put in who the buyers are, I put in who the sellers are, I put in who the lenders are, I put in the other agent's information, I put in escrow information and who the escrow people are. And all of these people will get logon and password information, allowing them access to this portal that I pay for that allows me to have absolute security over all the documents. So everything my folks sign are available to my folks and those folks who should see it 24/7 at this link. But they have to use a logon and a password to get access to it. So that way, your data is always fine. If you have an agent who has PDFs of your stuff that they're just emailing around, that's not good. Now, that doesn't really apply to the offer. I mean, the offer doesn't have any personal information, doesn't have your social security number. All it has is the address of the property in your name. So I'm not as worried about things like that. But any documents that your realtor gets their hands on that has all of your contact info on it. Now, there is a place for your contact info on the contract. If I'm going to email a PDF of an offer to the other side, I either encrypt the PDF file and using a different method like a phone call or a text or something like that, communicate to the receiving agent what the password is. I hate doing that because agents in general are stupid. And by adding an extra step that they have to go through, the likelihood is you just simply you add a failure point to the process. And whenever the failure point is somebody I can't control, I hate to do that. So I might do this secure download thing, but what I'll often do is simply not include your personal information where it's on the contract. Just your legal name is adequate for a contract. So I won't include your phone number and your address and all the other stuff that's on some documents that can get sent. And at that stage, it's not really necessary anyway. Okay. So what happened in my case? I already had a couple of little red lights going off, but what happened was I specifically right up front sent an email to this lender and to his assistant saying, I want to do secure transfer of documents. I don't want anything hinky. I don't want anything weird. I don't want anything funky. Well, the main lender never got back to me, but his assistant did. So his assistant said, just fax it to me. He didn't send me a link to upload documents, which I asked for. I said, I'd prefer doing this digitally and being able to upload it to a secure server. A fax is an okay second place for me. I consider it just slightly less secure from a digital upload simply because then your fax information ends up either in a server somewhere that may or may not parse the right names out, where it then gets sent as a digital file to somebody in the office, or it may actually physically print out. I don't think many companies are doing it that way anymore, but the idea of my paperwork just sitting on top of a fax machine all day before someone goes and gets it annoys me. So I don't like that. And remember, I've already told them I have concerns about the security of my documents. I'm anal about that, and I expect them to be anal about it. I've said this. It's not like I've implied it. I've told them. So I send him an email list, a summary list of just the title of all the documents I've sent him. It is everything. It is 50 pages of. So if you went to a site that said how to steal someone's identity most completely, it would be these 50 pages in terms of what they've asked for. Bank statements, the goofy little form they make you fill out with all of your personal information on it, W-2s, taxes for 2 years. So it was more than 50 pages. It was a lot of stuff. So I sent it to him. I listed it all off in just a list of the title of all the linked up with the stuff he asked for and said, please review and verify I've given you what you asked for. 1 hour later, I get a reply email from this assistant, including a PDF of what I sent them via fax in an email and said, here's what I received. Go ahead and check and see if it has everything. Okay, so this is the moment when the Rebel Broker pops his freaking top. I see this email come in with an attachment and I go, oh no, you didn't just do that, did you? So I see that yes, he has included the fax. The whole reason for me faxing it was to avoid emailing it. So the document I didn't want to fax or didn't want to email has now been emailed back to me after I fax it to him. I'm livid. I am exceptionally pissed off. For several reasons. One, this moron has no clue how to handle people's personal information. None. So yeah, end of story, period. That's enough for me right there. Number two, the answer to my question in the original email of, is this what you needed? Isn't, well, why don't you look at it and figure it out if it's what I needed? It's, yes, sir, I will look at it and verify you've given me what I need. That's the response. So I summarized those two points of view and sent an email and, of course, got profuse apologies. And then for a day or so, I kind of stewed about it. And I should have just fired them immediately. I should have just said, I'm done. I'm out. If this is the way you handle personal information, I'm finished. Ended up calling Tracy back because I wanted to give her a heads up. Literally, I'm about to call Tracy. I am about to dial the phone to call Tracy. My phone rings and it's Tracy. And she says, hey, hi, Robert. I wanted to check in with you. I wanted to see how things are going with the guy I referred you to. I had referred another client to him and he's not very happy. And I said, well, let me add to the story. So I did. And she said, I don't want you to think about it another minute. I've got another guy I can send you to. So let's move you on. So that's how that guy got fired. Now, the new guy has been great. The new guy has been fantastic. It's a little annoying that he decided to take a vacation over the last six working days because all kinds of crazy crap has happened over the last week that has caused me some frustration. So, but everything is still on track. And I think I don't think I'm going to talk about it in this show. I think I'm going to save it for the next time. Maybe not even the next time. Maybe for after, right? The day after title closes and everything is settled. And just so everyone is aware, this is a show standing on its own. I'm still going to do a show Sunday, even if there's nothing newsworthy that happens between now and then. We'll just sing some show tunes, which would be fun. When you're at that point where things are really at the beginning of the process, that's the time to figure out if this lender is going to work for you. So that your warning thing should be really poor communication, treatment of your personal information that's a little bit too casual. These should concern you. And you need to expect it not only from the lender themselves, but from their assistants. See, here's the thing. Every single lender is probably going to have two assistants that are working with them in one capacity or another. So you need to evaluate not only if you want to work with this lender, but whether or not you want to work with that lender's assistants. If you find a huge level of incompetence at any one of those three points, it can negatively affect your ability to make this deal happen. And I'll be really honest with you. I'm all for folks that are new to something or that are trying to build their career at something. But the minute I sniff incompetence, that's not the moment for me to go, hey, it's okay. It's a learning experience. No. That just means maybe you need to go back to training and have these things ingrained in you before you're trusted with somebody's actual information. I don't know how many years this guy that I was working with, his assistant had been around or in the business. Totally unacceptable, though. As far as I'm concerned, one of the key concerns of the modern age is keeping a tight grip on our identities. And the way that this was handled was so ridiculously, obviously, commonsensically, ridiculously horrible that there was really no question that I needed them to move on from that situation. And I'm going to suggest that you feel the same way. Nothing would suck more than going through this process of buying a home and then right after escrow closing, discovering that someone's gotten all of your personal data and you just bought a house in Manitoba or a car or a big screen TV or whatever. Maybe I'm a little more paranoid about this, but maybe it's because I've come across folks who've had to recover from identity fraud. And I swear it's the closest thing it comes to is people who describe to me dealing with kidney stones. Now, as a lot of you know, last year I had to deal with kidney stones. Single most painful thing ever. I mean, I had two of my fingers nearly severed. I've broken my collarbone. I've, been knocked off of a horse. I've been, when I was an emergency medical technician, I was punched in the face by a drunk guy. So I've had things happen to me that induce pain. I did a crazy ankle thing to myself in Hawaii a couple of years back. I'm familiar with various levels of pain. This was insane. This was crippling. This was constant motion to hoping that somehow that you'd walk away from the pain. So anyway, we don't need to go back to that. I think I may have already had this chat with some of you. So that's really the key part. And the best time for you to figure this out is clearly earlier in the process. The earlier, the better. If you start getting concerns midway through or towards the second half of the process, when things are really already moving, maybe the appraisal's already done. You've already spent money. Because if you get an appraisal and you change lenders, you're going to have to get another appraisal. They very rarely are. I've never had a situation where they would accept an appraisal from somebody else. I think there may be one exception to that. I think I had someone back out of a deal, and the very next person who bought, they were somehow able to use that earlier appraisal, but I'm not sure that's true. I'm not going to say it. Assume that you will be having to pay for another appraisal. If you can get through without doing that, fantastic. In my case, I'm not sure I would have had a problem since I just changed lenders within the same organization. It was the same company, just a different lender. So if we had been at that point, it might have been possible for me to do that. I'm not 100% sure, but it may have been something we could have done. Luckily for me, though, this all happened before the appraisal. Now, from an investment standpoint, we're going to be able to have some interesting conversations about appraisals and how to manage them and what you're doing. And, so much the investment process is so much different from the I'm buying my house process. Now, granted, there's still a lot of math involved in the buying a house process. But when it's an investment process, it's really just about numbers. It's all math. I mean, you're calculating whether or not it makes sense to buy this property based on how much money it will make you. And if the numbers come out red at the end of that equation, then you don't buy it because it doesn't make sense. It's not the reason to buy it. So for you, when you're buying just for yourself, I think it's actually more stressful. You know, I'm not sure where I was going with that. I was kind of segueing, but decided not to follow it all the way, I guess. So the bottom line is be just as critical of a lot of people just focus on the nuts and bolts of the lender loan deal, the package they're getting. And that's all obviously very important, but you also need to focus on how you rate the lender's ability to follow through with it. Is it as hard to find a good lender as it is to find a good realtor? I think it's a little easier. So much of the lending process is fully automated that really all you need to do is find someone who is competent enough to stay on top of it every day, gets down and gets their things done and stays in contact and keeps you informed. So it really comes down less to somebody who's really great at lending and really more great at managing a process, more of a project manager kind of a thing, and then personal interaction than it is the nuts and bolts. Because by and large, they sit in front of a computer, they put in the numbers, and the computer either says yes or no. Now, of course, that isn't universally true. Anyone who just kind of stays in the business and sees products coming and going and sees how things react and can oftentimes get a kind of a gut level feel for what's right and wrong relating to loan products as it might apply to some specific client. So those folks bring a whole new level of game to the process. Tracy, I would categorize as someone like that because she can kind of have this sort of creative process go on in her head. Well, she'll say, you know, I can think of a couple of products that might really work well for you in this scenario, right? Whereas someone who hasn't been in the game as long may not even know about those products, would have to go look in their little book of lending products or check their sources to figure out something else or ask someone more experienced. So I guess what I'm saying is on that front end, establish those two things. Establish that someone has a good follow-up policy that keeps you informed. B, a just ingrained systemic respect for your personal information. And then for that extra bonus point is someone who really seems in the business in terms of internalizing really the nuts and bolts of the lending process, having a gut feel for what works and what doesn't, has a pretty good not just a working knowledge of the loan products, but has sort of internalized them enough so that on a gut level, they're able to really kind of steer you in the right direction so that you not only end up with a situation where you're confident that the loan can be concluded because of the work ethic of the lender, but also that you're getting the best possible product that can be found to fit your specific needs because that person has that level of understanding of everything that's out there that's available for you. And frequently you'll be able to figure that out through the interview process. And, you know, feel free to ask the crazy questions. So I know a lot of folks are going to ask, what's the interest rate? How many points? Ask some other questions. Like, what was the most challenging experience you had as a lender matching a borrower to a loan? Right? Give me an example of where you saved the deal in the last minute by working some sort of lending magic. If someone who's been in the business more than 5 years can't give you a story like that, maybe you need to move on to someone else. And I'm not going to imply that it's a little bit different than it is with realtors, but longevity isn't the same thing as competence. Well, it's just that's absolutely true in real estate, but in the lending world, that's not necessarily true. Just because they've been around a long time doesn't necessarily mean they're particularly good at what they do. So just keep that in mind. It's fine to ask how many years you've been in the business. I guess that's great, but that shouldn't be your final analysis element, right? That shouldn't be I won't work with them because they've only been in the business a year. If they feel competent and confident to you, even though they've only been at it for a year and feel like they've really jumped in and immersed themselves in what they do, go with it. Don't let that 1 year experience hold you back. That person with 10 years experience may be burned out and tired of the process and just squeaking by. So All right. Let's see what else we've got here. A variety of neat little nuggets. The first one I wanted to hit was wage growth lags far behind home prices, report finds. Now, I find this interesting because we've talked a lot on this show about how to solve the real estate problem. And you don't solve the real estate problem by solving the real estate problem. Real estate isn't a quote unquote problem. We can talk about certain elements that I guess are a problem, like how much you believe the government should be involved in regulations or those kinds of things. But you don't solve real estate directly. You real estate gets solved through employed people who are making enough money to buy a house. For those of you who've tried to buy a house, you know that the paperwork you fill out, that's all they care about. They care about how long you've had a job, how good of a job you've got, how much money you make, and how much money you spend. That's it. You want to increase home ownership, or you want to make the market, real estate market, more robust? Well, more jobs would do that. The problem is what we've seen in what we're describing as a recovery, which is really kind of a real soft recovery, is we're not seeing quality jobs. We're seeing low paying jobs. We're seeing part-time jobs. We're seeing, you know, where we stop counting people who've given up because they couldn't find a full-time job. And you know, the underemployment in this country is a pretty wacky big number. And that's what's going to solve the problem. Interest rates are ridiculously low. You can't argue that interest rates should be lower in order to solve this problem. In fact, if you consider the bigger problems of the economy and what we're doing with dollars and overprinting money and having $17 trillion of debt and deficits versus debt, the only thing that can happen is interest rates actually have to go up. I mean, if anyone was alive when Carter was president, right, and we had the same kind of crazy crap going on, the way they solved it was higher interest rates, which were like at 19%. Well, we have a much bigger problem of the same kind now. Imagine what interest rates have to do in order to solve that problem. I guess they'd either have to go to 19% for a whole lot longer, or they'd have to go much higher than 19% for some period of time and then slowly start to come back down. But that's the thing that's got me wondering what the smart thing to do is. I mean, in terms of my decisions, what I'm going to do about my firm belief is that my money will be working for me best if it is traded for a thing of value. I'd rather have the thing of value than the money that can get me the thing of value moving forward. So that's why, you know, and this is going to sound nuts, but I know even a lot of my personal retirement stuff I've considered dipping into, and I've been trying to do math to determine if it makes sense, because you end up with that double whammy when you do that, right? You end up A, having to pay taxes on it, and B, getting a 10% penalty if you take it out before you turn 59 and a half. That's at least for an IRA. That's the info I have. And so I have to look at the growth, how much growth, what's my return on that money being there? And then if I compare that to projected earnings on investing it in real estate, at what point does the real estate overtake what the IRA would have been doing for me, right? And most IRAs barely keep pace with inflation. Rents have been more than keeping pace with inflation. And I don't think there's any downside to deciding I'm going to invest in something that everybody needs. Everybody needs food and water, and everybody needs a roof over their head. So no matter what happens, you'll always be able to probably find someone for the thing that you want to rent them or sell them. It's just a question of whether or not you can do that for an amount that covers what it costs you to own it. And I'm probably going to have another chat, another show kind of just focused more on the investment side of it. And we can talk a lot about that and what I've been doing in my personal stuff. Okay. Home price growth surges ahead of wage growth as investors and foreign buyers flood into Southern California. This is from the Los Angeles Times. And it starts off with the jobs recovery is no match for the housing recovery, and that's making it hard for many Southern Californians to afford to buy a home here. Now, here's my concerns with calling a lot of these housing things a housing recovery, because it's kind of an artificial recovery. It's really people too afraid to sell their homes. And it's people too afraid to buy a home. We've got low inventory. If we had what would typically be considered a normal inventory, which I guess a lot of people consider a normal inventory, 3 to 6 months worth of stuff, uh, I think we'd actually see prices going down. I think one of the few things that's really shoring up prices and pushing prices up in so many different markets is just the scarcity of inventory. Now, I'm seeing now on the upside in my personal marketplace, I am seeing more homes listed per month or per week. I actually tend to look at it weekly than I have seen up until this point. So we're definitely seeing that ramping effect as we move more towards the summer months. You know, I create searches for clients all the time. And when I do that, I assign it to them and then it emails them stuff. But I always look at that first result page to see if I see any real standouts. And oftentimes, over the past months, I've created these searches. And you know, it's a pretty common search. It's typically a 3-bedroom, 2-bath search, under $600,000 to $700,000, single family residential. That's the bread and butter search that I tend to see. Well, I've done searches in previous months where maybe 1, 2, maybe 3 come up, right? Did one today, 10 come up. So there's 10 active homes on the marketplace that fit that search. And that's the bread and butter search. So there's absolutely a market increase happening. As we've discussed before, more activity at the lower end than the higher end. The higher you go in price, you tend to see more inventory, and you tend to see a little bit more of an ability of a buyer to maybe get a more competitive price. But you're at a price point that's nuts. I mean, anything over $1 million is where we're talking, where you can typically maybe shave a little bit off or get a better deal, at least in my neighborhood. Totally not true north of here. In some areas, you're lucky if you can get something for $1 million. The cheap prices are $1 million in some of the communities north of me, which just makes me want to cry, frankly. So, you know, the activity's there. It's the inventory that's really, the lack of it, that's really driving numbers, I think. And I think you'd see, I don't think it'd be quite as robust if inventory was going up or higher. And we're going to cover a few more things that may influence this. Okay. Now, I wanted to cover this number because I thought it was kind of interesting. While the average weekly wage earned by workers nationwide grew 1.3% from the second quarter of 2012 to the second quarter of 2014, home prices in that time grew 17%. In Los Angeles and Orange counties, the gap was even wider, with home price growth of 28.4% compared to wage growth of 2.5%. This is why renting is going bonkers. Let me give you an example, another real world in my market example. Now, and Morgan Hill is a small community south of San Jose. It's still considered Silicon Valley, but it's really a bedroom community for Silicon Valley where people commute north from here. So prices aren't nearly as high as they are north of us in the heart of Silicon Valley. I decided to try to figure out what I could rent my house for if I decided to rent it. And then again, this is one of the pieces of advice I've given in the past is instead of selling your house to move into the next house, keep the house you're in, get an agreement to rent it, and then buy a house. As long as you've got a signed rental agreement, you can for the house you're currently living in, you can get a loan or a loan to buy a new house, just like you would in any other case, as long as you've got that signed rental agreement. And again, something else we'll talk about at another time. And I decided to do a quick search. If someone wanted it's actually a 4-bedroom with a bonus room because one room doesn't have a full-blown closet. It just has cabinets. So it's kind of a 5-bedroom. That fifth room serves as my office in this house. But I've got 4 bedrooms, so a master and then 3 bedrooms. If you were looking for the same number of beds and baths and everything that this home has, how many options do people have in Morgan Hill? Well, I poked around and found literally one house was currently listed for rent for $4,200 a month. So that was encouraging for me as someone who might be renting because I could rent it for quite a bit less than that and still make a little money. And my home doesn't have a lot of the upgrades that this other home had in terms of you know, a recently updated kitchen and that kind of thing. So those are things that you would jump through as an investor person if you're thinking about doing a lifestyle change in terms of moving into another property and then renting the home you're in. But these are all things that absolutely point to a crazy market situation in terms of price growth. The amount of price growth we've seen is ridiculous in a lot of these areas. And I would argue, like I did a decade ago, it's not horribly sustainable. And I think given a lot of the other things we know about what's going on in the economy in general, the market in general, it could be a creepy situation in terms of how sustainable is this? How long can this last? Will things keep going? One interesting thing to note is a lot of the folks who are out there prognosticating are saying everything's going to be fine right through 2017. I'm not sure what's supposed to happen after that. We've got one article that I dug up here that kind of talks about that I thought was a little odd. And that's the next one. This one's from the Origination News. It's from National Mortgage News. And real estate industry should see solid growth through 2017. So they're thinking that things are going to go well from now right until then. So I'm not sure what that means. I'm still seeing far more people looking to buy than to sell. Right now, a lot of my marketing is aimed right at sellers. So I've kind of throttled back on the buyer focused advertising and ramped up on the seller advertising. And I just don't see, I mean, even it's almost like a slider where I can move it up and down in terms of things like Trulia and Zillow, where they have advertising that's focused more on buyers and advertising that's focused really at sellers. And I don't get nearly the response. I just don't get the flow of sellers from that advertising. So I think it's very revealing in terms of where the mindset is out there. You get some folks who maybe see this as a great opportunity to potentially buy, but they're just unable to do it. And here's something else. So, and this is a conversation we had probably a little over a year and a half ago. I'm the hardest working guy in real estate right now who's not making any money because I have lots and lots of buyers. I started a new relationship with Veterans United to try to help veterans purchase homes. And I tell you, I've got all these searches running for folks who have contacted me through Veterans United, and they're just not finding homes because they're priced right out of the market. Other folks who I'm not finding through Veterans United, again, we've made offers, we've gone and looked at places, and it either happens that our offer isn't accepted, someone else has offered way over asking price, or we're going to make an appointment to look at it, and we go and we look at it and discover they've just accepted an offer. So things are moving at a ridiculous pace. It feels a lot like it did back in 2012, frankly, when we were seeing that we had that, or was it 13? I guess it was the first part of 2013 where we saw that really crazy bump where things really jumped and then went down in price. But we saw this kind of feeding frenzy for just a little while, for about 3 or 4 months in 2013. That was just ridiculous. And I don't know if that's this doesn't feel like a frenzy. This feels like a slow build. So even if you want to put aside discussions about, well, what things are influencing it? What are the things that are pushing things up or down? All I can tell you is right here, right now, it's tough being a buyer. It's great being a seller. I can't really tell you what's going to happen in a month. I can't tell you what's going to happen in 6 months. I can't tell you what's going to happen in a year. But I know there's an awful lot of things that scare me happening globally that can affect whether or not this market continues to grow. And I know a lot of the folks I trust who were able to anticipate the last big downturn are saying some pretty scary things about where we are now. Peter Schiff is a good example. If you want to get a little something that will keep you from sleeping well tonight, go queue up Peter Schiff on YouTube and listen to some of his stuff, and that'll scare the crap out of you, if nothing else will. Was there anything sexy in this one? This one from Origination News? I don't think so. Yeah, there was a couple of interesting commercial property numbers, but I didn't think that was something we needed to talk about. Here we go. There was also one mention of red flags here. The report nevertheless did raise some red flags that could signal problem areas for the real estate industry, particularly single family housing starts, which are expected to increase to 900,000 units in 2017 from 647,400 in 2014, would remain below their long-term average, making this the only indicator with lowered forecasts compared with ULI's previous survey 6 months ago. Mayer, in his analysis of the ULI findings, also noted other areas for concern, including the possibility that higher short-term rates could squeeze investment returns and cause increased capitalization rates. He also warned that the potential always exists for other negative factors putting a damper on real estate growth, such as foreign crises or oversupply situations. And that's something else to keep an eye out for when you're reading these articles, if you bother to. By the way, just a little plug for my Twitter feed. I am tweeting stuff all the time that is in some way directly related to help you see what's happening in the marketplace or see things that could influence the marketplace. So sometimes, unlike a lot of other guys out there putting Twitter real estate stuff out, they'll only do real estate stuff. Interest rates, sales are up here or there. Now, I do that, but then I'm also going to, when I read an article that piques my interest because it might dramatically affect our currency or something, I'll go ahead and post that. There's interesting stuff happening in China right now, which is a scary thing. Made in China is starting to go away. You might want to do a Google on that. If their GDP drops below double digits, we've talked about this before on the show, they're in big trouble. And countries like that, when they're in big trouble, tend to point at other countries and goes, it's their fault. And their response isn't necessarily going to be ships on our shore or tanks being dropped by helicopters into our houses. It's going to be, we don't buy your treasuries anymore, which is what facilitates us maintaining this gigantic debt. It gets sold in the form of treasuries that other countries buy, right? It can be all kinds of different stuff economically that they can do that should scare the crap out of us. So there's a lot of things out there that I point out that I think help inform a broader understanding of a lot of the things that play into this stuff. All right. Next, I always love pointing out Las Vegas. I think Las Vegas is almost kind of a canary in the coal mine kind of a situation. Their sales increased 8.5% year over year in March. Pretty impressive. Compared to March 2014, sales were 6.7% higher for homes and 17.1% higher for all types of condos and townhomes. By the end of March, their Association of Realtors reported 7,257 single-family homes listed without any sort of offer. That's down 0.8% from February and up 12.2% from 1 year ago. What's interesting is their inventory is up 12.2% from a year ago, but sales are only up 8.5% year over year. So what I want to know is, what does that mean for prices? And I'm almost sure there was a mention of that here. Okay. Overall sales were up 8.5% year over year. Conventional equity, not distressed sales were up 18.6% year over year. In March 2014, only 75.4% of all sales were conventional equity. In March of 2015, 82.4% were standard equity sales. So they've had a significant, it's been a complete turnaround. They don't have foreclosure sales anymore. They have conventional sales going on. The percent of cash sales has declined year over year. Totally normal. When things start going conventional in general, investors go away because no one wants to pay retail. And that's what people are paying now. Non-contingent inventory is up 12.2% year over year. The table below shows the year over year change for non-contingent inventory in Las Vegas. Inventory declined sharply through early 2013. And then inventory started increasing sharply year over year. It appears the inventory build is slowing, but still ongoing. Again, if you want to read all of this in its entirety, you can head on over to Calculated Risk Finance and Economics. It's www.calculatedriskblog.com. And the title is Las Vegas Real Estate in March. Sales increased 8.5% year over year. Anything else sexy? No. All right. So, you know, the market, the sales are increasing. And what I'd like to see is a chart of average prices. Usually what you'll see in a market like this is you'll sort of get the impression that the prices are going up, when what's really happening is just the old inventory of prices over higher priced homes is getting sold out. So a lot of times what will happen is you'll see at the beginning of something like this, sales in general are going up, which kind of artificially boosts that scale to look like higher priced home, that homes are in average going up. But remember, that's just an average of the prices of homes that have sold. So for a while, that's going to go up. And then a lot of times it'll peak. It'll go down a little bit as things normalize. And then you'll see things kind of flatten out. So we'll see how that goes. Now, here's another interesting one, because it feeds in exactly to what we've talked about on this show so many times about businesses that in the downturn with the foreclosures bought tons of real estate when they're not in the real estate business. And this is an article from the Business Insider. Article came out April 10th. GE is spinning out most of its $500 billion GE Capital assets, selling its $26.5 billion real estate portfolio. That's the sexy part for us, and planning a $50 billion buyback. So I hate GE with a passion for other reasons. Maybe someday we can have a show about why I dislike GE so much. But I won't buy GE products, and that's my little way of, you know, sticking it to the man, I guess. But they're doing a buyback of a lot of their stocks and holdings and whatnot, but they're getting rid of $26.5 billion real estate dollars. It will sell nearly all its real estate portfolio to investors, including Blackstone and Wells Fargo, for $26.5 billion. So, and here's the quote from Jeffrey Immelt, but I don't even like saying the man's name, so I'm not even going to get into that. But I thought that was interesting. I think this is one of those things that fits in with what we've talked about, where these guys were not in the business of real estate. They simply saw a situation where these things were going to go up in price, and at some point decided this is where we want to sell it. And we, earlier when we talked about this, we tried to figure out what should that tell us as buyer and sellers. Well, depending on how much faith you put in whoever's managing GE's real estate portfolio, they see this as the time to sell the portfolio. They're getting out of the real estate biz, which indicates to me that whoever they're listening to says we're very near the top. This is a good time to liquidate. You're making X amount of money. That's a good return. The computer program says sell it. So let's sell it. And I think we're going to find a lot more of this, where the computer program tells them sell it. And there's, and we've talked about tons of different entities that have done this, that bought up huge blocks of foreclosed properties at auction from the government. So now that they're not in that business, we'll see where it goes. We'll see if this ends up somehow. It sounds like they're going to be selling these to institutions. They're not going to actually be just saying, all right, let's put out for sale signs in front of all of these homes. It may not, and that may not even be what a lot of these holdings are. A lot of this real estate portfolio stuff may be just, I'm guessing it's going to end up being real estate and not owning mortgages. But I'm not 100% sure that after reading this. It says their real estate portfolio. So it sounds to me like they're selling actual properties to these investors. It's not a very long or involved article. Well, they include the full release, which I didn't read at the end, but anyway. But I think this is sort of the beginning of that. This is going to be the beginning of the cycle. And I said that at the time that when this starts to happen, look to see what happens in the market. Is it, do things stay flat? My idea was that if these folks actually did liquidate these, in other words, put them on the marketplace to sell in the market to another owner of the property, it would boost inventory, which would actually serve to stabilize prices. So it would A, indicate that folks believe we're at a stabilized point, and B, potentially feed the reality of a stabilized price by having more homes on inventory, right? In certain markets, in the big markets where these are held. So where would be big places that this would happen? I think Las Vegas is a big one. I think Phoenix is a big one. I think parts of LA are a big one. And I think some parts of Silicon Valley, San Francisco Bay Area, maybe. But most of those have already gone through the process of being resold because of the crazy amount of growth we've seen here. So I'm not sure it would be quite as big here. Another new bit of news from San Jose Mercury News: Bay Area home sales and prices jump again. It's really ridiculous what things are doing here. Bay Area's hot economy and the limited number of properties for sale have pushed the median price for Santa Clara County homes to a record high, $879,000, and the rest of the region is not far behind. Median sale prices in Alameda County climbed to $665,000 in March, a hair below the 207,000 peak of 669,500, according to data released Friday by real estate information service CoreLogic. So we're right there. Yeah, and then they talked to some realtors who are stupid, and that's not important. March sales increased by 19.5% from a year ago in Santa Clara County and by 24% in Contra Costa County, but the sales volume dipped by 3% in Alameda and 2.1% in San Mateo counties. Taken as a whole, the nine-county Bay Area saw a 10.3% increase in sales. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think a lot of the folks here, I think, are optimistic about what prices are doing. The inquiries I get are people who, when I have a conversation with them, are kind of stunned at how much they can get for their house. So I'm pretty confident a lot of those folks are going to turn into clients in terms of getting their home sold. From time.com/money, the article is this spring's hottest real estate markets. I thought it might be fun to talk about the hottest and coldest real estate markets. Gone in 60 days, where homes for sale are going fast. Now, this is data that comes originally from Trulia. The fastest moving housing market is in San Francisco. Interesting. So in 2000, and it's going, everything's going faster than it did last year. And in some cases, a lot faster. San Diego, frankly, saw the biggest change between 2014 and 2015. But number one on the hit parade of the fastest sales is San Francisco, California, where I'm actually surprised. Well, wait a minute. No, so a bigger number is better. That's the percentage of homes that sell. No. Okay, so lower number is better. Sorry. The percentage of homes that don't sell, I guess, has gotten less. So, and they're talking about a 60-day time frame. I'm sorry. I'm speaking in a circle here because this is a confusing chart. San Francisco is number one. San Jose is number two. And that's my secondary market. So I don't service all of San Jose unless I'm working with a specific kind of buyer. I mean, I'm not a big fan of all of San Jose. Grew up in San Jose, went to school in San Jose, but I love South San Jose. I love the South San Jose area going up to Cupertino and Saratoga, which is kind of where I grew up. I grew up in the Cupertino, Saratoga area and went to Lynbrook High School over in that part of town, which is officially in West San Jose. So I love that area. I'm a big fan. So if I've got clients who are interested in that area, I will occasionally work with those folks if I really like the clients. But so number two is San Jose. Number three is Oakland as far as moving houses. San Diego is number three, and Orange County, California is number four. Slowest moving markets. The worst moving is Albany, New York. The next worst, the 99th worst, is Long Island, New York. The next worst is Syracuse, New York. The 97th on the list was Columbus, South Carolina. And 96th on the list was Knoxville, Tennessee. I don't know. I've never been to any of those places. Yeah. So I have nothing to say. Our two-month measure is similar to a common housing statistic, days on market. In general, housing markets with more inventory and fewer buyers will have a higher share of for sale homes remaining on the market after 2 months and a higher median days on market. I notice here the San Jose number where they're saying just under 30% are still on the market after 60 days. I can't remember the last time it took me 60 days to sell a house. Okay. $1.5 million house in San Martin. That one took me a heck of a lot longer. That one took me longer than 60 days. But I judge myself by the average home in that marketplace. So a home of that type in that marketplace was normally being sold in like 200 and something days. And I sold it in like 110 days. So I shaved 100 days off the sale time. That's one of the ways I measure my performance, right? And that's one of the ways I suggest you judge agents is, you know, in this area, if a home tends to sell in 60 days, well, then you should expect your agent to be able to beat that, right? And do it under 60 days. Hold them to that. If they don't, there should be a penalty. They say that they can sell your house for $200,000. If they fail to do that by a certain amount, then they should be penalized, right? So I've built that into my business. I just recently did that within the last year or two. And my clients seem to like it. So I haven't had to pay anyone yet, which may upset my clients, but at least they get what they want. And that's a good thing. Nationally, 6% of homes listed for sale on February 5th were still on the market on April 5th, down a bit from 62% for the same period last year. What's quickening the pace of sales? It turns out it's homes priced at the low end of the market. To see this, we evenly divided all homes in each of the 100 largest U.S. metros into three price tiers. And this is great. You know, this is one of the first times I've seen Trulia do something really smart. Now, I do the same thing when I'm analyzing prices, and that's when the discussion of price brackets come in, right? We've had this chat before. If you're a longtime listener, you know that I break properties into brackets. Now, they've done it universally across the country. I do it on markets based on activity. So when I start to see peaks and valleys in activities, I let those peaks and valleys define price brackets. And then that way I can intelligently advise someone, well, you know what? If you just price this home $5,000 later, you'd be within this peak. Instead of being in this valley, you'd and get maybe two eyes on your house, you'd be in this peak and you'd get 50 people looking at your property, right? That's a way to manipulate those brackets. And it really is just a way of seeing where, for whatever reason, people are gravitating to certain price points. You're always going to get a crazy peak down low. But bizarrely enough, there have even been period of times where I've seen peaks between $850,000 and $950,000. So if your home was priced at $990,000 and you're in this valley, if you just dropped the price $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, you get far more people looking at the house. And then that house ends up selling for over asking price because so many people ended up bidding on it, right? Try to sell it at that higher price point. You don't get as many eyes on. You may only get one offer. So you may find yourself in a situation where you accept below your asking price because that's the offer you got, right? It's if you're doing that kind of stuff, I think you're really working the market to your advantage. All right. Anything else truly sexy? California is home to America's fastest moving housing market. If you're a home seller, California may indeed be the golden state. 8 of the 10 fastest moving housing markets are there, and homes are selling much faster than in the Northeast, South, and Midwest. In fact, fewer than 30% of the homes for sale in the 3 San Francisco Bay Area metros remain on the market after 2 months. Yeah, and I'll tell you what, in this marketplace, if it's taking you, if your property's on the market, if you live within the sound of my voice, if I were to go out my door and scream and you could hear my voice, if it takes longer than 60 days to sell your home, your agent's a moron. There's actually a home listed just down the street from me that's been on the market for 2 months, and I'm shocked that it hasn't sold yet because it should have. Anyway, all right. And then it gets into some details about Albany and Long Island. Great article. I mean, if you want to sort of get the broad view here, again, it's from time.com/money in their real estate section. This spring's hottest real estate market's definitely worth a look if you are so inclined. CoreLogic. Again, from Calculated Risk Finance and Economics, Southern California sales up 5% year over year. That's really it. That's sort of just the big payoff. Data shows 18,156 new and resale houses and condos sold in Los Angeles, Riverside, San Diego, Ventura, San Bernardino, and Orange counties in March. That was up 35.6% from 13,650 sales in February and up 5% from 17,638 sales in March last year. That's the more important number. This whole month-to-month thing is stupid. Focus on the year-to-year number. Here's one from I'm not going to read this. This one's stupid. I was kind of on the... maybe we'll hit the headlines. 7 costly mistakes of new real estate investors. This comes to us from the Mail Tribune, and I'm just going to hit the main points. This is a very wordy thing, but I'll just hit his 7 things. Matching their strengths with investment types. Absolutely. Go with what you know. Go with what you're comfortable with. Number 2, lack of understanding valuation. It's important to understand how things are valued. That's a conversation I want to get into more as it relates to investing, as it relates to appraisals, all that kind of wonderful stuff. A home appraisal is not a true estimation of value. The only true estimation of value is an offer that closes. It's what the market will bear, and that's not what an appraisal tells you. Underestimating time commitment. Yeah, I mean, it can be absolutely, you want to try in a lot more time to manage your real estate investments than you think you'll need, because odds are you'll end up needing it anyway. But as you get over the learning curve and you become more efficient, you'll find ways to manage this stuff. I'm going to do a great show on tools that are available to real estate investors to manage all of this stuff. So if you're someone who's going to do vacation rentals, which can be very high maintenance, there are some great tools out there to make it very easy to manage. Inadequate contractor knowledge. This is an important one that really only experience is going to teach you. Getting contractors, you don't necessarily want to hire a contractor. You want to be the contractor, and you want to hire subcontractors. Being able to hire, manage, interview, identify them, you know, figure out who the good ones are. That's also very important. A lot of times your real estate agent can help you with this. I know several great contractors that will let me go directly to their subs. So, you know, sometimes you can get a really good contact that way. Inadequate tenant experience. I would call this inadequate tenant screening, frankly. You need to be able to identify good tenants, and you do that by screening them. That's the number one skill any landlord needs to learn first, and it's one you can't afford to ignore. You got to do it. Disregard landlord-tenant law. Yeah, know the law. I mean, you know how you have to treat tenants in your state and county. And if you don't do it right, you do not pass go, you do not collect $200, and you could lose control of your property for a very long time, and it would be annoying. No established maintenance plan. Whenever you take on a property that's going to be investment, you should try to get an idea of what you're going to need to worry about in terms of maintenance. And that means anything that's included in the rental that you're responsible for, washers, dryers, refrigerators, disposals, toilets, everything. On a piece of software, you can take the estimated life of each one of those things, put it in there, and then amortize that to a monthly cost. Like maybe for a toilet, it's only 50 cents or a dollar or $2. Maybe for the water heater, it's $3. But all of those things, calculate that out as a yearly or a monthly thing that you put aside, you take out of the proceeds to put towards the acquisition of a replacement when the time comes. And that's really it. He used a lot more words than I did, but I don't think they're necessary. MBA mortgage application increases, purchase apps up 16% year over year. That's really the sweet shot on that one. Seasonally adjusted purchase price index increased 5% from 1 week earlier to its highest level since June 2013, 16% higher than the same week 1 year ago, which is really the number you should care about. I don't know why I feel like I'm suddenly getting a cold. A few comments on March existing homes. This is actually a pretty good article. It's not very long. I'm actually going to suggest you go and you read this one yourself. It's on Calculated Risk Blog. The title is A Few Comments on March Existing Home Sales. Came out April 22nd. Just to kind of hit the big points here. Inventory is still very low, up 2% year over year in March. More inventory will probably mean smaller price increases and slightly higher sales, and less inventory means lower sales and somewhat larger price increases. This will be important to watch over the next few months during the spring buying season. And that first paragraph absolutely encapsulates what I'm suggesting we all need to calibrate ourselves to. There are a few things in the wind that if we do see an increase in inventory, I think that's good for the market. I think that stabilizes it. The only interesting thing that's kind of unknown is what the Fed's going to do with interest rates. They have to go up eventually. If they don't, we're hosed. Rents soar in San Francisco, rise 3.7% nationwide. So across the whole country, rents were up 3.7%. But the influx of tax money fueled San Francisco rents up 14.8%, while nearby San Jose jumped 12.3%. Rents averaged more than $3,000 a month in these areas. That's roughly $600 more than the rent in the Los Angeles area, $800 more than Metro New York City, and $1,000 more than the Washington, D.C. area. And then they go on with more some of the various areas where this is happening as well. They cover some of the other metro areas. That's from the San Jose Mercury News. Absolutely worth a look. A lot of people would argue that there's a chance we've kind of missed the boat. If you haven't already sort of jumped on, you've sort of missed the boat on getting this rental thing going. I would argue that that's not necessarily true. If you currently live in a house that you own, you made the boat. That can be your first rental property. So there's ways to jump in. There's ways to start making this happen. There's ways to start living the goal of having your property make you money without buying a property that you plan to rent. You already own the property you can rent. You're in it. So let's say you want to move into a new property. What you need to do now is figure out a way to move into that new property without selling the property you currently own. And again, that's going to be in another show. And we're going to go through that, because here's a little teaser. There's a really huge chance I'm going to be doing that exact same thing. And I'm trying to entertain what I'm going to do to facilitate that. And I've come up with options that that go the complete gambit of a little bit nutty to really not so nutty. And we'll talk about those at another time. All right. Finally, Lawler, D.R. Horton, net home orders up, prices flattish, says if prices are low enough, there is demand from first time buyers. And that's really kind of it. From housing economist Tom Lawler, the nation's largest home builder reported that net home orders in the quarter ended March 31st, 2015, totaled 11,135, up 29.9% from the comparable quarter of 2015. They must mean 2014. The average net order price last quarter was $284,400, up 2% from a year ago. Home deliveries totaled 8,243, up 33.1% from the comparable quarter of 2014, at an average sales price of $281,300, up 3.7% from a year ago. The company's order backlog at the end of March was 12,177, up 21.1% from last March, at an average order price of $293,500, up 4.6% from last March. So growth, but flattish. I think that's, I don't think flattish. I think flattish is it. We've been talking flattish here on this show for a long time. All right. We're coming into the home stretch here. Let's talk a little bit about interest rates, where everything has gone up except for the 5-1 adjustable rate mortgage, which makes total sense to me. I've always thought the 5-1 ARM and conventional stuff were way too close. There needs to be some separation between those two to make the adjustable rate even make sense at all. So what we're seeing right now is the 30-year fixed rate mortgage is at 3.71%. That's down 0.05 from 3.66. Still relatively low in a 52-week range. It's down towards its low of 3.55. The 15-year fixed rate mortgage is at 3.04 right now. That's up 0.03 from 3.01. So not a whole lot of change. That's the smallest change is the 15-year fixed rate mortgage. Its lowest point was 2.95, highest point 3.52. So again, still hovering down at its lowest 52-week point. FHA 30-year fix is at 3.4 today, up 0.1 from 3.3. So that showed the highest amount of increase. And the jumbo 30-year fix is currently at 3.65. Up 0.04 from 3.61. Again, all of these hovering way down at its lowest. The 5-1 year adjustable rate mortgage is at 3.03, down 0.04 from 3.07. It is nearly at, it is 0.03 away from being at its absolutely lowest point in the last 52 weeks. So I guess if for some sick, twisted reason, you really just had a hankering for an adjustable rate mortgage, this would be a great time to do it. I think the jumbo 30-year fix is a ridiculous deal at its given point right now. It is nearly at its 52-week low. The only other one that's kind of still good is the 15-year fixed rate mortgage. But you know what? For my money, I'd go 30-year fixed, but pay it like it's a 15-year. There's only a 0.4% difference. Not quite a 0.4. There's actually a 0.36% difference between the two. So you'd basically pay it off in, if you paid it like you were doing the payments on a 15-year mortgage, you'd pay it off what, in 15.8, 15.6 years? But that leaves you the flexibility to not have to make that payment. If you're hitting a tough month or something weird's going on and you need to stay a little bit more liquid, you can just do the normal 30-year based payment for a month or two, and it gives you that flexibility. So I know in my current planning on what I'm doing, thinking about doing financially, I'm planning on making 15-year fixed rate payments on the loan I'm going to get, but I'm going to get the 30-year loan. And given certain things that have just happened, I may actually go with a 15-year mortgage on my investment thing. Well, we'll see. I have to talk to my guy and get some options. We have to come up with some plan Bs based on some funky crap that we had to deal with over the last week. So anyway. All right, folks. I don't think this Sunday will be a investor focused show. I actually think I'll name it something specifically letting you know that it's an investor one. I'm kind of surprised that, I don't know, maybe that's just one person out of everyone who listens to the show. But whenever someone emails me or goes to the trouble of contacting me, I always assume there's got to be at least 100 other folks who with the same opinion who just aren't bothering to write in. But yeah, they for whatever reason, there's a lot of folks who don't like hearing the investor stuff. So I'm not sure about how to sequester that. So we'll see. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll completely ignore it all and just keep it all blended. But we'll see how things go moving forward. I am honest, I swear, not intentionally avoiding doing the show on a regular basis on Sundays. The last time I sat down, I just ended up getting a call from someone who needed to see houses, and I had to leave and go do it. And if I get that groove disrupted Sunday morning, it's often very bad, hard for me to remember to get back into it later in the day. So I apologize. I realize that this inconsistency is not a great way to build a show. It's not a great way to keep folks who do listen to it and get something out of it happy. But you know, at least you know that when I'm not doing the show, I'm out there getting information or getting some firsthand experience that maybe I can bring to the show when I finally do one, and you'll benefit from that. So I hope we can all put that positive spin on it and keep that close to our hearts as we move forward. So I hope you all have a great night. It is 9:24 and I'm going to go sleepy times. Again, if you have any ideas, observations, suggestions, or anything you'll need to ask me or want to know that you'd like, or maybe you want me to cover something on the show, feel free to do that. There's a variety of ways to get in contact with me. Probably the absolute best way is just head on over to the site, www.soldbyrobert.com or www.therebelbroker.com. Both of them have a contact Robert doodicky on there somewhere. Just click it. You don't have to know my email address. Go in there. Let me know who you are. Let me know what you want to know, or let me know what the comment is and send it my way. Happy to reply to anything that comes at me that way. If you'd rather get me at me directly, just you send an email to therebel@therebelbroker.com. That's an email address that works, the one I use on the show. You can also call me at 408-852-0525. That's the actual real estate number. There's a good chance you'll get the voicemail, but go ahead and leave me a message. I'll return it. I frequently find the thing rings when I'm actually with another client. Out of respect for the client I'm with, I usually won't take phone calls. That's it, folks. Hope you have a good one. We'll talk Sunday, most likely. And catch up on your stuff.